title of the talk today. Can you hear me? It's okay. Yeah. Is inheriting the earth. There's a person who's known as a very, he's one of the more famous gurus, no longer living in the body. And he's one of those people that I secretly feel like a friend. This is the first time I'm saying out loud that Neem Karoli Baba is my friend. I never met him in the body, but. He's known to have said that all the money in America is mine, he said. And some of the people who love him would have different experiences of going into the bank and seeing him just leaving the bank. And then they would go inside and find unexpected things in their bank accounts. This kind of thing. After he'd left the body. So, while he anyway only lived in India, they'd go into US bank, see someone wearing a blanket and nothing else, leave the bank. And be surprised happily when they went inside their bank. There's a kind of fine line, because someone else could say, all the money in America is mine, and we would have a different kind of reaction. We might also laugh, or we might run away. And we know maybe these two parts in us, the one that's overconfident in that kind of sick kind of way, and the one that's overconfident in a real kind of way. I came across a book that I was given when I was 12 years old that I couldn't read at the time. And I happened upon it in a library in the States this October. It's called The Prophet. And I couldn't stop reading lines from the book in that retreat there. It's just very nourishing to read a text written in English. The original language is English, by someone that wise. It's not so common. And so I'm just curious how many of you know the book, have heard of the book? And I'm just curious, out of those, if it's from, she's read it four times, from the 60s song, or was it 70s, 60s? The children and their parents. That one? Okay. So you actually know the book. That's wonderful. I had known the book in the sense that it was on my shelf in my room in my mother's house for 32 years. I was usually not at my mother's house, but still. I felt that I knew it because I saw the cover for all those years. And luckily, I was brave enough to open it again. 32 years later. And I want to read one line to talk about this kind of confidence. I think we can still call it overconfidence that this teacher Neem Karoli Baba, who wore a blanket, had when he said, all the money in America is mine, and meant it. And then because he meant it, because he knew that to be some kind of truth, it made different kinds of experiences available to people. So in the beginning of the book, it starts straight off describing the prophet himself and calls his name and says he was the chosen and the beloved. And so just those two words, what does it do to you to hear them? It could easily be like, he over there was chosen, I'm not, and he was beloved and I'm not. That would be one way. But if we can sometimes come across that place in us that is the chosen and the beloved. A dawn, that's when the sun comes up, like this morning was just sparkling. A dawn unto his own day. Delicious. What does it mean to you that someone is loved and somehow chosen, and he is his own sunrise to his own day? Anyone?
He is his own, his part of him is his own force here, and he arises anew to it every day.
She said this part of him is his own torch bearer, so light bearer, and he rises new to it every day. That's one person receiving the line. Anyone else find words coming? Feel free. Yes. The chosen and the beloved. A dawn unto his own day. I feel a kind of completeness. Not waiting for some other sun to come up. Not orbiting around any other light than what comes through. And I think this way of receiving the line can help us find the fine line between the two kinds of overconfidence, the fun kind and the sick kind. I think the fun kind has a very big sense of humor, big enough to say all the money in America is mine, for example, and just wear a blanket, like the kind in the Gandhi ashram that's like 100 rupees, that kind. I've only met, to be honest, like maybe 5 to 8 people who seem to me to be completely overconfident in some kind of way. Otherwise, I find that we're a kind of a mix of very underconfident and very overconfident, depending on the day and the situation. But if we could be ready to agree that there may be a part of us, a place in us where the sun can rise and it be enough. Enough for the whole earth. Because the sun is not just for one person. It's too much for one person. It would burn one person up. Apparently, in some of the texts from Tantric Buddhism, when people would go on pilgrimage, so they would knowingly start walking towards a place they thought of as powerful and holy and transformative. That would be pilgrimage, I think, at that time. Today is a full moon, so there will be at least 100,000 people coming to this town to go around this mountain. Partly because there was a movie that someone got their wish fulfilled when they did that. And there's one story that I find very touching of, I think it was two gentlemen who set off on a pilgrimage. And they were walking along and they were very surprised that nothing special was happening. It was just kind of fields with goats and a few mountains, a few trees. Walking along, waiting to get to the holy spot. And then one of them suddenly kind of stopped in his tracks and said, "Wait, we're on pilgrimage. We're already on pilgrimage. We're already in the process of arriving somewhere powerful and somewhere holy." There must be something wrong in my attitude if all I see are goats and fields and thorny trees. And so he stopped for a while. And this is the story that's handed down.
The story that?
Is handed down. Thank you for asking. Feel free to ask if I don't speak clearly. That suddenly the one guy who stopped, not the other one, the one guy who stopped realized that the kind of girls wearing rags who were tending those goats were tantric teachers who then gave him teachings. So it's, to me, a good example of this overconfidence, that something that my mind says is nearly worthless is certainly lower than myself, which sometimes seems to be pretty low, could be something other than that, could help the sun stream through, could help the sunrise. It would be so easy to try to decide to be on pilgrimage and to decide to try to find the tantric teacher in every goat herd or goat herdess. And that easily starts to be the sickness. Coming from a hurry, coming from a place of not enough. So coming from a place of not enough, if we start our pilgrimage from there, we're in a hurry. And then the question always ends up being, what does it mean about me? It stays as a self-centered, kind of almost superstitious thought process that just eats us up. It doesn't feed us. It doesn't rise over the whole earth. But sometimes then we want to run away from that self-centered thinking, still having started our pilgrimage, having started our movement from the place of not enough. And then we find this self-centered thinking that's eating us alive, and still not enough, not right, not good. We try to get away from that. We try to go somewhere else. And it always ends up being the wrong direction. It always ends up being away from our inheritance. Inheritance, do you know the word? It would mean, if you're in that kind of family or relationships, that someone has a lot, and when they die, some of that or all of that goes to you, becomes yours. So in a way, what it means is what we receive without particularly deserving it, just by having been born where we were born. And I'd like to talk about the human inheritance as I see it. And this overconfidence that could help us receive it now. And at least to start to feel what blinds us to that inheritance. And also what helps us value it. And even what helps us go and live there. Live in the land that we didn't earn and that still belongs to us. The place that belongs to us without our being good, working hard, earning it. A long series of coincidences. Are there any questions? Sorry. So a long series of coincidences had me in a van looking at properties in Spain to buy. And in Spain, in general, there's a very different relationship to land than what there is in the United States. In the United States, people can move from one coast of the continent to the other, from 1 week to the next. Whereas in Spain, for example, I've spent a lot of time within the nation of Spain. There's a country called Catalonia. And sometimes people might say how much it would take to pay someone to move from Barcelona to Madrid. Or Madrid from Barcelona. Sounds like, when the people talk about it, that is unpayable. And so sometimes there might be a piece of land, maybe with a few stones that used to be a house, that belonged to a family. And it was on the market to be sold, but by the time someone wanted to buy it, one brother or one sister or one aunt had decided they didn't want to sell anymore. It's so difficult to think of selling this property. But it's not that anyone wants to live there. And when someone, usually a foreigner, a lot of people from England and Germany, from cold and rainy parts, eventually have found a way to buy land in Spain. And then even if you buy the land, the response is, why would you want that? A piece of land in the middle of nowhere with a ruin on it. So it's kind of overvalued in a way, like we couldn't think of selling it as a family. And at the same time, undervalued, why would you want that? This is more or less our relationship to our human inheritance as well. We don't want to completely sell out, or at least we don't want to think that we've completely sold out. Or we wouldn't like to think of using that resource in a new way as cash, to put it in a more positive tone. But we don't want to go and develop it or use it. We don't actually want to even visit it. So now, living many months of the year in one of these kind of lost, middle of nowhere pieces of land in Catalonia in Spain. When we go into the village, people will say, ah, you live in that valley. ah, this valley used to be so beautiful, it was like a garden, every single centimeter was cared for. And we used to walk the 3 kilometers to pick the salad for lunch every day. Ah, so you must like to visit. No, 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 I've never been. The people of the now, the post-war generation, you could say, haven't walked over the hill to the spring. And so it's too easy and tricky just to think, ah, I have a human inheritance over there. That used to be, that could be, like a garden that we could eat from. So I want to just mention one danger in this teaching about our could-be garden that belongs to us for no reason. I have seen enough people take the idea that I have this could-be garden and stop there. And then after a few months, when the excitement of the idea has worn off and they feel miserable and hungry and they wonder where the salad is, why isn't there any salad if I have a could-be garden? It's very easy to blame. It's especially easy to blame oneself. I received the best and highest teachings, and look at me. I'm hungry. So I didn't actually start out to state this so strongly, but I'm going to say I have more than one friend who came to the point of being suicidal because of this thinking. I received the highest teaching that I have a place in me that is of the most value, and I'm suffering. Therefore, I am worthless. Or it's probably more like, I can't deal with this. I can't deal with figuring out what's going on here. So our reliance on expectations, plural, as our vehicle, as our way of getting around. It's kind of like we want to have something to deal with life for us. And so we go for expectations. Which always drives straight into the wall of blame. Always. Today or next year. Or both. And the fuel for the vehicle, the fuel for this way of getting around, is comparing. Being up, being down, and even being equal. Being same, same. It's not true. Is it true? Is it true that you could be higher or lower or equal to anyone? And then maybe somehow that kind of excitement of running into the wall again and having to clean up afterwards, save up for a new car or whatever. Maybe different kind of vehicle altogether. We'll go for the boat, helicopter. Let the vehicle be there. Let the fuel be in the tank. Don't get in the car. Don't get in the helicopter. Don't get in the boat. Walk. We want to go fast because we believe we do not have this inheritance. We even experience we do not have this inheritance. We experience a sense of not enough. And so we think we need special help to be human. So we need the car or whatever. Instead of like wrangling, struggling all the time with the fact of our expectations, comparing, blaming, which uses shame as its kind of force, enforcement. If we can find what helps us remember not to get in the car at all. That we don't need to hurry. Can you understand? I notice that I'm starting to speak with a little bit Indian accent so that I don't speak American English. Anyone have something to say? Please. Feel free.
It seems to me when you talk about not enough, that sometimes the quest comes at least from a sense of not enough, but not a bad sense of not enough. Mm-hmm.
Can you speak on that? Great. Exactly. Good. Could you hear? So she said sometimes, and I'll add the word genuine quest, comes from what seems to be a sense of not enough. But it seems to be a good kind of not enough. And if I could speak about that. This is where the overconfidence comes and a kind of trust in our life. That out of life and our experiences of aliveness, there comes an honesty about our potential and a being drawn towards our potential, being drawn towards letting the garden grow. And doing whatever we can to let the garden be every centimeter. It's the difference between like a plant growing, which the plant is reaching up to the light. It does need rain. It does need good earth. It probably also needs love somehow. It needs so many things. Nadia's a gardener, that's probably why this particular idea comes. Too much wind at the wrong time, etc. Does not help. We need to find what helps us live there in the place of our inheritance, because just by living there, it is obvious what needs to be done and easy to do. We just happen to walk even just walk past the garden and we can see everyone is thirsty. And it's very easy to go late to work if I just water the plants first, because I know if I don't do it right now, they will be dead by evening. And so I'm doing out of love, and out of having experienced letting them die by evening and feeling the pain of that. The kind of not enough that makes us get into the car would be, I don't know if it's even worth fitting it to the garden, but it would be where we didn't even walk past the garden on the way. There was not even a window of that aliveness. But maybe we could say it could be even I walk past the garden, I see the plants are thirsty, and something kind of just freaks out instead of reaching for the water or whatever. And so I don't have the confidence to be the waterer. I think I've got to go find the plant doctor. That would be one example. A little bit lame. I think maybe an even more realistic example would be we worry so much about how the plants are not doing so well that we actually never quite manage to go and water it. I think that's what usually happens. We worry so much about how I'm not maybe being a good enough gardener that my energy goes into thinking about it so much, it feels like I've done so much gardening and then I've got to at least do a little bit of something else. But we actually never got to the garden. We didn't actually see the plant, we just saw our image. I think that's what happens a lot. I guess we could think of a few different things that happen from the sickness of not enough that are not growth. One is, well, it can't be my garden. It's too good. Or somebody else has got to help me deal with this. I can't. I'm not good enough. Or I inherited it. Why isn't it growing by itself? It's already perfect or whatever. Or this, we do it so much mentally that we forget to actually. Yes. She said reading books, so we stayed up all night looking up to find whether that's a fungus or something. And then we're so tired in the morning. Death and growth. If I can summarize this conversation about two kinds of not enough without any metaphor, and I said death and growth.
Inside also to the two kind of
overconfidence. But I would also still say not enough and enough. Not enough, then we have to go to the car, to go to the store, to get the chemical or whatever. And enough, we walk and we know it's going to be slower at first. We're going to be aware of how slow. But actually, we're going. What happens when we walk, we just put our feet on the ground, one after the other. We do what helps us remember our inheritance and live there. connect with what is already godly, what is already, what already takes us beyond our personal past. Also, a line from this book, The Prophet. It almost feels not right to call it a book. It's much bigger than a book. In the story, he's been 12 years in a foreign land, and he goes up outside the town and he looks out to the sea and he sees his people are coming for him in a ship. And it's a bittersweet time of realizing that there is a lot of love between the people that he was their outsider and him. How much neither side realized how much love was there. And so they ask him, before you go, please tell us what you saw of us. And different people ask different questions, and someone who is probably, I would say, his lover, who is also the priestess, says, tell us about relationship, tell us about marriage. This is another famous one. And since, in a way, if we start on a pilgrimage, and there's this possibility of noticing our relationship to everything and how much that affects what we receive. Relationship to also to outside and to inside. I find this, the words about relationship in the Prophet very, very helpful. And there's one image that especially resonates with me. He talks about being two strings on a lute, so on a guitar, on a stringed instrument, be like the two of the strings that do not touch each other. You're not on top of each other or under each other. You're not better or worse or even equal. The fact of not being on top of or under each other, but being in the same instrument, allows the strings to quiver to the same music, to vibrate to the same tune. And this is what I experience also. When we kind of, in a way, go out of relationship as we know it, there's left some space to vibrate to the same music. It's something that would be worth trying even right now by looking at something or hearing something, a rock or a leaf. And noticing the expectations, assumptions, interpretations, past, history, etc., and then what is left in a relationship without expectation or blame? Is there anything left of relationship as we know it? Open question. But you could try with a stump of a tree or a leaf or a rock right now if you wish. When the weight comes off, we resonate to the same tune. And so starting to notice what helps us live there or here. And it can be this misunderstanding that, okay, I accept that I have this garden that I've inherited just by being alive, and I'll try to be there as much as I can, or be here as much as I can. The expectation, the idea that it should already be that garden that's every centimeter well cared for. It's impossible. It's not real. What seems to be real is by being there more and more, we start to notice what needs to be done. And we start to free up the power to do what needs to be done. And to not do all the other stuff. To not do what we thought we should. To really not do what you think you should. Really not do it. One thing I experience in the quivering, in that resonating, as just one string, doesn't have to be the only one, the best one, the worst one, just one string. It has the music. Who knows how? I use the word love, even though for some people the word is, that's the wrong word. And so I want to say a little more of what I mean by this word love, L-O-V-E. Love as a power, a freeing power, a dissolving force. So it is the power that gets me over myself enough to water the plants. And sometimes not to water the plants. Because if I always water the plants, I'm also killing them. And so it frees me to do my meditation practice. And it frees me to stop doing my meditation practice when it's time to stop and have some tea. It's a continually dissolving force. It dissolves also, thank God, thank goddess, thank goodness, whatever, the spiritual ego. Oh my God. One way that it dissolves what has been and it dissolves what's coming into being, which is a wonderful, slippery feeling, breezy feeling. It's not trying to be kind, trying to feel compassion. It's quietening down into a place that it's not that I like the rock because I like the rock. It's like, ooh, the power of the rock vibrates with me. And there's friendliness. And so we're connected to this music. We're connected to a flow, as I said before, bigger than my personal history and my personal future, but also fresher than this moment, even fresher than now. And pretty easy to kind of fall into touch with via now, with the help of now. But it can be confusing if we just think we're trying to be now, trying to be now, trying to be now. Sometimes in that now, there's something even fresher than now that we would like to, like, fall into. That something in us would love to have permission to fall into. And so then love can dissolve that tension of, I should be now. What is the phrase? Eckhart Tolle?
The power of now.
The power of now. Yes, thank you. And just lastly, there's one other part about the power of love. Okay. Now I understand. Not just the power of now, but the power of love. Which you might prefer to call the power of consciousness or whatever you want. Power of truth. Power of aliveness, whatever. The biggest misunderstanding about love is that it always says yes. But our experience of love is that it very often says no. And if you're not sure about that, just hang out with the mothers. for a few minutes and find out how love says no. And hang out with the children who are with their mothers or not, and find out how children love says no. It's a no that's this growth, so pushing off of aliveness into aliveness, rather than trying to push away from something to get somewhere else. The baby pushes out of the womb. It is not no to life. It is also not no to mother. And the mother pushes the baby out of the, if all goes well, out of the womb. And it's not no to life, and it's not no to baby. It is one of the biggest yeses. It's also lovely in the prophet, just to end now, when someone asks him about love, and he says, yes, love, yes, that's true. Love is good, and love is also very, very painful. And if you only want the easy, very, very painful, as well as joyful. And he says, if we only want the happy, easy, better to just dress ourselves again, put back on the protection, and walk away. And he says, okay, you can do that. You can walk away from your land. But your laughter will not be all your laughter, and your tears will not be all your tears. And we could add, your life will not be your life. Your inheritance will not be yours. The sun will not rise for the earth through you. Is there any question or a comment? You did intensive?
Intensive satsana did over a full month here in India also. I had this realization that there was nothing missing really, that I was already whole and complete. And I couldn't, anything I could think that was missing was just kind of a thought. Yet I feel like there's always another satsana to do, another retreat to attend, another thing to kind of. And when you were talking about this garden not be already completed in a way, in every centimeter not growing, it kind of helped with this kind of paradox that I was feeling within me, like, is it, am I kind of running after something, avoiding what is already there, or there's more to do, really? So I don't know whether you would comment.
From that ease of complete, there's no stopping you. And it can, the ease can really say yes to what is also difficult to go through or to do, even to go against. And maybe it's the feeling the different tone in the ease of complete, still unstoppable. that in a way loves to let the garden keep growing and find that the way that the garden, okay, this year there's more cherries and this year there's not so many mushrooms and so there can be a joy in discovering what we've never known before that's helpful, or what we've never done before that's helpful, or in letting go of what we thought we needed that we need not. And in the not enough, it's so hard to even think of not already being perfect, not already being finished, that everything gets cramped. And it's like the love is not allowed to free our actions and release what is old. So getting to know the different sense in the not enough feeling and in the complete. And what makes enough of a window that we just naturally fall into the complete more and more often. And what kinds of things kind of rev us up into the not enough. Fear, worry, etc. Believing in the kind of solidity of the past also. Expectation, blame. And then all of those symptoms of the sickness also start to become more joyful reminders of coming home. So even I notice blaming, and it's not, oh God, blaming again. Bad girl. But kind of falling back home. And in the one side, it's another word for the not enoughness really is ego. Ego. I just never like to use that word. Ego in the commonly used way, not like technical.
Then I think I felt some anxiety in your talk because I felt like maybe it's exactly as what you were saying. So am I watering the garden? Before when I started talking about it, I thought, and then I got this anxiety. Is it so black and white?
Sometimes it can really help to make a really simplistic black and white in the very subtle. Like in the moment that the anxiety comes and says, oh, maybe I'm not watering the garden. It could be a valid question, but not going on that pilgrimage from the anxiety as a starting point. So coming back in whatever way helps you to come back to the feeling of being watered or watering. That's the lovely thing, is we get to feel both. We feel watered when we're watering. But we don't always see, we have the expectations that the things should grow faster. So if we're looking at the bigger picture, it's much harder to know. Am I watering the garden in the best way?
Sometimes it's important.
So I would suggest this practice with, in the more moment to moment, without getting compulsive, obsessive compulsive or whatever. Being sensitive to how it feels when it's the anxiety or the not enough. In the moment. Like this thought, that feels like the not enough thought. What if I just don't believe? What if I just tune into the sound of the sprayer? Or whatever, anything almost, to kind of interrupt the habit of anxiety. And then you do feel watered, and your face is looking watered. And in the, so that's one side, is in the moment to moment, notice the different tone. And cutting through the habit of anxiety and should, expectation and blame. And in the bigger picture, in my experience, people who have maybe information that you need about how to water or whatever, often happen by, and maybe we can invite them in. Like being ready to invite them in to just stroll through our garden. Because there, it might be a good time for a major change in your practice, if you're feeling barren. But that from this place of the love of aliveness, and the confidence that that's what you are for. And the fine line is between being able to investigate that without falling into the feeling of being wrong and not good enough and all these years wasted and da da da. I have one thought I can throw out and tell me if it might have something to do with it, where your finger wants to go. When we go to our home, there's a certain kind of aloneness that we have to face, that we have to accept. Just like the two strings. Like we're used to signifying togetherness by being tied together and on top of each other and better and worse. And to actually stand alone in that way, in your inheritance. It can feel isolated or isolating. If we're not used to receiving and welcoming or being around enough music, enough help to feel the music or whatever. It's alone because it's your place. It doesn't belong to anyone else. And it won't be the way anyone else did it. And the meeting is in the music. But there's also a way that all those who have gone before, they're not impatiently waiting for you, but they are really ready to welcome you to their party. Like, no hurry, but there's a place for you at the table. But with the sound of your string. That's not anyone else's. To trust that we could go without demanding, and then what needs to happen will happen, is a big challenge for us. Okay, for now? So we have the chance for doing what you like to do now, between now and supper, whether staying in the hall or we often call it the sunset walk time. And just to remember how walking can be very healing and grounding thing to do in this context of the retreat. Thank you very, very much.